every bout of exercise that is strengthening or working on a component of fitness. So, for example, that bout you've just done of, what, 10, 15 sit-to-stands, some of you did a few more, you will have a hormonal effect on the body. So you'll have a burst of growth hormone rushing around you right now. You'll become more sensitive to insulin. Therefore, if you repetitively do that, you're less likely to get type 2 diabetes. Cortisol's an interesting one. Cortisol is a hormone which actually is often associated with stress. And as we get older, we produce more and more of it. And actually, if you do lots of strength training in particular, you reduce the amount of cortisol that floods into your system. So the bad effects of cortisol are weight gain, sleeplessness, and depression. Of course, which are all things that we associate with aging. So if we're able to do regular strengthening work, we're going to reduce the amount of cortisol. So all these things are really useful for you and I to know. Don't necessarily have to impart all of that to the older person. And in the long run, particularly the very frail, these are the important things. If somebody just broke up their sitting, they don't do any exercise, just don't sit for long periods. And we know this from people that get on planes. Deep vein thromboses, constipation, ability to safely transfer, all of these things are going to improve without a specific exercise program. So it's important to always think about moving more often, not just an official exercise program per se. Okay, I think I've covered that. Okay. You have two handouts of purple on top. We've got a big project going on here, the material resources that have come out of the project about sedentary behaviour. And as you can see in the briefing, it's a briefing for professionals, not for older people. You'll see all the detrimental effects of prolonged sitting. And then just think about all the settings that you go and work in and that you're doing in your placements. What's the first thing that you offer? Everybody gets offered a seat. Hopefully when you assess somebody in their home, you walk about with them. But it's amazing how many of the conversations, at least, they're sat. Waiting rooms, buses, there's always places for older people to sit, so it's culturally normal for them to sit. Now, 8 to 12 hours is their self-reported sitting. When you put monitors on them, depends on whether you're looking at community dwelling or whether you're looking at care homes or whether you're looking at hospital. In hospital, the average sitting or lying time in their waking day, so that's from when you've woken them up at 5:30 with all the medications going around and stuff and to when they actually go to bed, sleep, you are looking at them sitting for 19 hours or lying. So if you're lucky, half an hour in that day, they're going to get up and go to the loo, or get up to have something done. They're going to sit the rest of the time, or sleep, or lie. Going to a care home, it's around about 16 to 18 hours. And you go into the community, it's around 12 to 15 hours, as an average. So, if you just broke up, if those people just got up once an hour, that's an extra between 10 and 20 sit-to-stands a day. That's an exercise prescription for strength training. So this is what I mean about sometimes we just forget simple things about not necessarily talking about exercise, but about breaking up prolonged sitting. Okay. The other issue, and some of you may or may not have seen this in your placements, sometimes when you give somebody an intervention, so for example, you say, you know, you should be doing this TheraBand exercise or whatever at home, they'll do that, but by doing that, they stop doing anything else they used to do. So if they used to do a slow walk to the shop, they don't do that because they're now doing an exercise that they've been given them by a physio and they think that's better. So they compensate. They just do the one thing they've been given and they stop doing their other daily activities, which obviously isn't good either. So this mindset of older people is something you really have to get your head around so that you are constantly encouraging them to move. So technically, sedentary behaviour is anything where they're sitting or lying and they're not using much energy. So if they're doing a seated exercise class, that doesn't count because they're using a lot of energy, usually, in an exercise seated class. But if they're sitting and just watching telly, or they're sitting and dozing, or they're sitting and reading, they're not using much energy at all. And that's the time point at which you'll start seem to have these detrimental effects. So, these are so far, some of the shown to be independently affected by the amount of time you sit. So irrespective of what activity you do, if you sit for prolonged periods, you're going to have worse muscle strength, worse bone health, bigger waist-hip ratio. And what worries me, and I think you guys are really in an important place to ensure this doesn't happen, is that we are such a risk-averse culture. We don't want falls to happen in care homes or in hospitals because of the suing that's going to come out of it, or the telling off by line managers or whatever. So most people end up restricting activity, whether consciously or not, so that there's less likely to be a fall on your watch. And of course, in the long run, if that's all the older person ever gets wherever they go, they will assume it's good not to move. So they'll go home and not move, and they'll get much weaker as a result. So if we spend our whole time wrapping them up in cotton wool, of course when they leave our company, they're not going to move either. And I'll give you a prime example of this. I've been lecturing about physical activity, ageing and falls for many years. My father is well aware of what I do. He's been and heard me lecture. No problem at all, fully gets it. Was ended up in hospital for a month in Edinburgh Royal Infirmary. And it was a bit of a nightmare, month all round, because every time I went in an evening to try and help mobilise him, I had to battle the nursing staff to allow me to mobilise him. So every time, turnover of staff was such that every time I turned up, I got somebody going, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" I'm going, "I'm taking him for a walk." "Why are you taking him for a walk?" "The physio hasn't assessed him." And I'd look at them and go, "I train physios, I know how to assess my provider." And I went, off I would go again. And it's every single time I went to that hospital, I had to fight to mobilise my father. And at the end of it, he said to me, "Well, I think you're just making such a big thing of this, Dawn, because it can't be that important. If it was that important, somebody else in the hospital at some point would have told me it was important to move." And of course, because nobody did, and I was the only one, he just thought, but I was the awkward one, as opposed to... And so it's, if everybody does that, then we're going to have this functional decline that occurs every time an old person goes into hospital. And we talk about bed blocking, but actually... sadly, we're half the time we're causing it because we're not encouraging people to move in those settings. Now, I do appreciate if someone's had a hip fracture, you're not going to get them to mobilise every hour for the first few days. It's not going to happen. But the vast majority of people that go into hospital are not that frail. They could quite happily just do a sit to stand. I'm not talking about walking along the wards and doing stairs. I'm talking about just sitting to stand next to the bed. So, what's going on again about rehab wards. I'm really going to make this point. So these are a couple of research studies in rehabilitation wards, the place where you most expect the people are moving most often. So stroke patients spent 8.3% of their waking day standing. It's far too low. It's not going to rehabilitate anything in the long run. So we need to make a big difference in this, and more importantly, it needs to... And I have this conversation regularly with physios, it shouldn't just be a physio doing it. It should be any person that comes into contact with that person. So the nurse, the healthcare assistant, anybody needs to be, the patient's relatives. Care homes, well, you're lucky if they spend 1% doing anything that gets them slightly warmer. really, really small amounts. And they're spending 80% of their day in front of the telly asleep. I went to a conference a couple of weeks ago, everything's into technology now, and there's been a whole raft of new research on robots, basically. And I have spent my life going, you cannot, don't take away the interaction for an older person. They need to see it speak to person, not a robot. But what they've done is they put, and you might have seen these on telly, they look a bit like seals, white seal pups, but they're robots. And it's a slight size of a seal, so it's about this big. And it's got these lovely big eyes that look at you, and it turns its head every now and then. And if you stroke it, it makes a sound. And that's all it is. It doesn't interact in any other way. It's like a very expensive baby toy that you get for your child. It doesn't pee everywhere. But what's fascinating is they've put those into a load of care home communal lounges. And they've noticed that the TV nearly always stays off, that the residents interact with the seal almost the whole day. And often they will stand because the seats are taken already by other people, so they'll actually come and stand and interact rather than just immediately go and sit down. So it's fascinating. Something really simple like that seems to make quite a big difference in their engagement with things. So then, certainly what they call vacant time in front of the telly has vastly reduced every time, everywhere they put these robots into place. Okay, I'm going to now hand out one thing, and we're going to be active for the last 45 minutes or so. So, put one in front. This is a functional fitness MOT. We developed this here actually as part of the Glasgow Science Festival, because at Glasgow Science Festival, most of the events are for children, but they nearly always get taken to the Science Festival by their grandparents, and so we were asked to produce something that would engage grandparents in understanding of science. And so we decided, because at that point physical activity guidelines had just come out and nobody knew them, we thought what would be good is to put something into place and get them to understand what strength is, what balance is, what flexibility is, etc. So we developed this MOT.
Awesome.
For those of you that don't come from the UK, MOT, you've heard of car MOT, maybe? So we every year our car has to be checked that it's roadworthy, and that's by the Ministry of Transport, MOT. So because we know of that as a cultural thing, that the car has a health check every year, we thought we'd play on that and we'd call it a personal MOT rather than a, just in case you didn't understand what that was. And this is what they take away with them, so they can reflect on it. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a go, not on all of the tests, but have a go on some of them, because just want you to actually get the feel of what this is all about. Now, the reason this works so well is that rather than just talking to somebody about being more active, by doing a functional test that most people can do, and you'll see that in a minute, when they do it well, it's not a matter that they can do it, is that they then compare themselves to the normative data at the same age, so suddenly they go, oh God, I'm worse than somebody who's my age. Yeah, exactly, it pulls out the competitive spirit in them. And then they're more likely to do something to try and deal with it. So, I'm going to suggest that you get into pairs. You can be in threes if that's easier, don't mind. But one of you is going to be tested, and the other ones are going to do the testing. If you've got time, you can have a go. If we just talk through each one, because we're not going to do all of them, but we'll do some of them. So the chair, sit and reach. This is a hamstring flexibility. Why is a hamstring, any idea, why is it important that my hamstring is flexible? Any idea?
Can you read it?
It's for good walking. If they're really tight, I can only do little steps. If I have good hamstrings, I can do a proper walk. So that's the main reason. The other reason is they can bend down and pick things up off the floor more easily, etc. So, hamstring flexibility. What they'll tend to do if you give them a seat is they'll come back here. You can't do a hamstring for two, you have to get them to come towards the front of the chair. One leg goes out straight, nice straight back, and you're just going to get them to go down. How far can I reach before I start bending my back? Because that's my back flexibility rather than my hamstring. So you actually want to stay nice and upright and looking forward. Okay, so I have rubbish hamstrings. So I can just about go below my kneecap. I can cheat and roll and bend, but that's not my hamstrings anymore, that's my back. Yeah? So, and they will cheat, so you need to watch at the point at which they bend and start twisting, and you make a note of where they actually are. Yeah? So, on that, you can see there's a measurement. Chest and reach, where I am. So, 50 centimetres. I'm measuring it from the toe up. So, if I could only reach to just below my kneecap, I've got a couple of rulers there. It's the You're going to measure between the toe and the end of my fingers, or your fingers. So what you'll see on these two graphs is that men and women are different. So please put yourself on the right graph, or you might either be a lot better or a lot worse than you actually are. And you'll see that with age, there is quite a big drop. And eventually,
If the reach is short of the toes, it's minus.
So you're going to measure, but it's going to be a minus. If you reach past the toes, it's going to be positive. Yeah? First one you've just done. How many times can you fold your arms and can you get out of your chair in 30 seconds? So there's a couple of stopwatches here. Now, when you do this with an older person, they'll do a couple and they'll go, I'm just going to have a rest. The 30s, the stopwatch stays going, but if they manage to get another one in, you can count it, yeah? So, hence you can see, you can have somebody that could do 20 and somebody that does 3, yeah? So again, you can see there's a big drop in women in the older age group with that. So you can have a go at that. Back scratch. So you're going to get them to put one hand across the top, one hand at the back, and you're going to measure the difference. I've got really rubbish, as you've noticed. in the old days, I could actually overlap, but I can't anymore. So if you overlap, it's a tip. If you miss, and there's a distance between the fingertips, that's a negative. Just use the old ruler. We are not doing research here, so you don't need to do it to the millimetre. Yeah? It's just a rough idea. We're then going to get you to measure 8 foot up and go. How many of you have heard of a timed up and go? Yeah? Some of you use them in your services at all? Timed up and go with older people? No? It's a very good predictor of falls. So, this is not how to do it, because I'm not going to bother to measure out 8 foot, but I'm going to do a rough 8 foot. Okay? Timed up and go is stopwatch. You're going to measure how long it takes for me to get out of my chair, walk around the bollard, come back and sit down again. I am frail and forgetful, so as I walk back, you have to remind me to sit down or I won't. And then you're sitting there with a stopwatch. Sit. ideally, you notice I'm starting at the front, because again, if they start here, it's going to take 5 seconds for them to move forward to the front of their chair. You're only going to measure at the point at which the bottom leaves the chair. So even if there is a lot of faffing, it's the point at which their bottom leaves. They're walking at their comfortable pace. Please do not tell them to run, because you'll have a fall. So it's their own comfortable walking pace. They're going to walk around the bollard, walk back, sit down, and you're going to measure the time it takes for them to do that. If they were frail, I'm not suggesting you necessarily do this with people at home, but it gives you an idea, and is there a reason why you couldn't pick one or two of these and do them at home, if you wanted, just to give them an idea. If they're particularly frail, you should walk with them. Not in front of them, and not chatting to them, as Leanne was talking about earlier, but near them. They can use their walking aids. I've seen some hilarious ones in the past. Zimmer frames on wheels and they're shooting around the thing, so you know, be a bit careful with that. But essentially, timing, I've left the seat, our timer's off, I'm going to walk slowly around my bollard, back again, and sit down. Click. So you've measured your time. Then we're going to do the grip. This is one you guys always... These are hugely expensive research ones. you can buy these in Amazon for about 20 quid. They don't look like this, but they're plastic. But there's no reason why you have to have a really posh one. But I don't know if you're aware, but the most common predictor of mortality is hand grip strength. Bizarrely. So, you're going to hold it just down by your side. You're going to do an isometric squeeze. So you're going to squeeze and for about 5 or 6 seconds. And my suggestion is always, because it makes a difference, is that you encourage someone. Okay, so 3, 2, 1. Squeeze! Hard as you can, hard as you can! And relax. Okay, so I used to do that. I got a good score. I've got 35 kilos. Give or take. And then please reset, because otherwise everybody who's weaker than you is always going to get 35 kilos. So, you and then maybe, for example, luckily my age group isn't quite on here yet. but I would then look at my age and look at the kilos and go, God, I'm rubbish. so you have a go at that. I think that might be, oh no, we'll just do the last single leg stance. So that is standing on one leg, and you're going to ask them to do that and measure the time that they can do that. Now, that means if somebody on standing on one leg drops a foot slightly and touches it, that's it, stops when the toe touches. So it doesn't matter if they choose to do all sorts of weird things like stand on their leg or... That's fine, but do remember that they could fall at that point. So if you're going to do this, you're near them or they're near something they can put a hand on quickly. And the other thing to suggest, because it makes quite a big difference, if you've got them to look out the window while they were doing it, and a bird flies past, they'll fall over. So that ideally they should be facing a plain wall with something that they can focus on. It's not something that's got movement in front of it, yeah? So I'm going to suggest that you have a go either in pairs or in threes. Can I suggest that whoever has a go, much as I know you want to, but being a bit like an older person, because otherwise you're always going to do really well and it's not going to give an idea. So have some older person in your mind, your grandparent or something, and mimic them a little bit and have a go. And just read the thing through, just so that you understand what that test is for, why it's important for them. Yeah. There's a couple of rulers here for measuring reach, there's a couple of handwritten machines here, and there's a couple of stopwatches. And if you wanted to look at the protocol for the actual test, the original protocols are all here, so just help yourself. So we'll have 10 minutes or so with you, or maybe quarter of an hour with you having a go at those.